The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is Brett King, your host. I am coming to you on the road today. Actually, I had a pre-recorded segment with number 26 coming up, which we recorded in the New York studios a few weeks ago. I'm just about to have an interview with Erica Young, who's coming live from London for us, but I'm personally on the road. Last week was Beijing. Arizona is where I'm doing the show from right now, and heading to Taipei tonight. So cool. Anyway, thanks for joining the show again. Just the latest in the news. If you've been watching the news, the big bad banks in the US are starting to cut access for aggregation services like Intuit, Yodlee, and MX, Money Desktop, and Geezio, and other services like this, Cash Edge. They're basically throttling the traffic or restricting it entirely, saying it's a security problem. But is it a security problem or is it a data problem? Let me ask you this question. Who owns your data about your bank account? Is Chase and B of A and these organizations who are throttling access to aggregators, do they have the right to restrict you to get access to your own data on your own accounts? That's the question. And the big banks are going to say cybersecurity issue, fraud issues, and so forth. But name me an instance of fraud or a threat that has occurred because of an aggregation service that you know of. I don't know of any, right? I don't know. So I think this is, you know, we're starting to see some traction and some movement on this, and the banks are responding. What else is happening in the news? You know, there's some news about the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, starting to open up a API and regulatory sandbox. Santander has signed a global PFM deal with Moneyga, you know, the PFM provider out of Sweden, Stockholm, I guess. So there's a few bits and pieces there. All right. So right now, I would like to introduce Erica Young. And Erica and I met at the Anthemis Hacking Finance Retreat in Switzerland, or was actually in Mirabel in the south of France, in the French Alps. It was a very nice setting. And she has a really interesting background. She's been involved in robotics, working in China. And so I wanted to get her on the show because, you know, we love geeking out with this sort of technology. So Erica, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I understand you're actually in London today. You've moved to London, right?
Yes, I just recently, about 6 weeks ago.
Great, fantastic. So we were talking about your work in China offline, and you were based out of Hong Kong. How long were you there?
I was based in Hong Kong for 7 years, and I actually started traveling there on business back in 2004 as an industrial designer.
Okay, so, and you ended up in this field of robotics and automation, yeah?
Yep, that's correct. So I me and two other co-founders who I'd gone to undergrad with at Georgia Institute of Technology decided to spin off a company from the MIT Media Lab in human-robot interaction. So we were focused on behavior change and the healthcare space. And we had developed a technology to build and maintain a relationship between a human and a robot. And we were looking for that to physically manifest itself as kind of like a personal coach, a robot that would help you to keep track of your health, manage a chronic disease, deal with medication compliance, these types of issues. And that's actually what first brought me to Hong Kong to live and work.
So can you talk about the technology you guys are working on in some more specifics? Because this is going to be a huge area. I was talking to you about the fact that I've been working on this book, Augmented, and one of the areas where there is the most promising application of robotics is in healthcare, particularly in a market like the United States, where we've underfunded nursing training and nursing development significantly. Absolutely. Over the last 20, 30 years, combined with the fact that we were importing most of our nurses from countries like the Philippines, and the recent immigration lockdown has made that very almost impossible. So it's a chronic shortage of nursing staff. And so there's some really promising applications of robotics to fix some of that. But tell me about what you guys are working on.
I absolutely agree, and it is a huge issue. And it's not only in the West. You also see it, for example, in Japan, again, because of immigration laws, that that robots become more and more valuable in these spaces. And the main reason is a lot of these types of conversations are quite repetitive, but having a physical presence of a robot makes it more engaging than a screen-based interface. And that's right. Basically the underlying research that led to this. And the idea stems from HCI, from human-computer interaction, is basically how do you create an engagement between a computer, a machine, and a human that is beneficial to both, that's engaging, that has a clear user interface, right? And if you look at social robotics, if you can build in certain social cues into the interaction, like a shared point of reference, making eye contact, these types of things, then it helps facilitate and make that interaction more natural. So you can imagine if an elderly person who doesn't have as much experience with technology, this makes it a much more easier engagement for them.
So are you talking about teleoperated robotics?
Or? No. These are actually robots that that can think independently. So they have there are two ways you can look at artificial intelligence. You can look at it as kind of broad and or domain specific. And so these robots had what we would call domain or subject specific AI, where they could have a conversation independently around a certain set of topics. And so in healthcare, usually once you've sent a patient home, there's a set number of metrics or set of information that you want to collect on a regular basis. And instead of using a person to do that work, a robot can help you maintain that over time. So that's basically what we're looking at. So it would be a guided interaction where the robot would have a conversation with the patient and ask them specific questions, ask them to input certain information, and then encourage them to keep going and make sure that they remember why it's important that they do that over time.
Okay. And what was the form factor like for these robots you were developing?
You could think of them a little bit like an appliance. So they would sit about the size of a blender. They would sit on your countertop. They would have 6 degrees of freedom. So the neck could move around, the eyes could move around, and they could blink. So again, enabling very basic social cues. And then most of the interaction would either be voice activated or through a touch screen. So it's not too dissimilar from, some people might be familiar with the recent successful Kickstarter campaign for Jibo, yep. Which is also a socially interactive robot. So the CEO of that company was actually a student of Cynthia Brazil in that same lab. So the same concepts, stems from the same place.
That's very interesting. So you call it Georgia Tech, right? And MIT.
Georgia Tech and MIT.
Yeah, so
the MIT of the South or the Georgia Tech of the North, depending on that.
Okay, I see. Because there is some interesting form factors that are making, like Pepper, is a robot that has some emotive cues and stuff like that. But so where do you think?
Really interesting. I actually got to meet Pepper for the first time at Web Summit last week.
Okay.
And when Pepper is off, its arms hang beside its by its sides, and its head hangs down, and it just looks so sad.
Sad.
And it's so interesting how you project certain emotions and anthropomorphically onto products like
There's been a lot of discussion about the uncanny valley and stuff like this, but you know, the interesting thing is we can make robots human-like, and we do anthropomorphize them or give them human characteristics, but they don't have to look like a human, do they?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's a famous sketch of a cartoon of shapes. It's like a triangle, square, and a circle, and it's amazing how much emotion you can project through action with very, very simple shapes. What I would say, there is a lot of discussion of whether the uncanny valley exists or not, and perhaps in the future, as robots become more ubiquitous, that conversation will become mute. But I think for now, it's really about managing expectations. If you have a robot that's extremely lifelike, then you expect it to operate at a very high level. And so then when it fails to do that, your expectations have not been managed. Right. If you have a robot that's quite simple in form, then I think that it's much easier, to manage expectations and make sure that the interaction is perceived as fruitful on both sides.
So tell me about, though, is this actually live, this technology? Is it still being prototyped? What's the status of this stuff?
Well, I think there's certain, like, for example, there's another robot that I worked on recently, which is called the Insight FD, which is a fire detection robot. And that actually is deployed in 10 provinces right now in China. So that is actively being used. There's got to be over 100 of them in use at the moment. So there are some technologies that incorporate these types of ideas that are in active use, both in the consumer level and in the industrial level.
The population of robots is just growing exponentially right now, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Yeah, I don't think it's growing quite as fast as the Internet of Things, but a close second.
Yeah, well, they're Internet of Things mostly as well. So why China?
Well, if you look at there are a number of factors. From a manufacturing perspective, the ecosystem that you have in southern China is just, unparalleled. You can get pretty much any component that you need within a 50-mile radius. The other thing is that the most successful robots, commercially successful robots in the U.S. market, have all been manufactured in Guangdong, which is in southern China. So the iRobots Roomba, the RoboSapien, Pleo from Ugobi, any of these robots that have been commercially sold in the U.S., all manufactured in a very small area.
There's a good base of competency in actually building this stuff.
Absolutely. And then I think in comparison, and price point-wise, it's much cheaper than, for example, doing it in Korea or Japan. The other thing is that it's a much easier market for the sale of the robots as well. Japan is quite insular, and they tend to prefer homegrown companies, so it's hard to penetrate that market from the outside, where China is much more receptive to foreign companies coming in and selling a product because there's a perceived quality with it.
You know, in terms of the field of robotics, which fields do you think, like healthcare, are going to be influenced the most by robotics over the next 10 or 15 years? Where's the investment going right now?
I would say a lot of it is still going into automation. You see, like, for example, Rethink Robotics with Rodney Brooks, Baxter and Sawyer are looking at the more collaborative side of industrial applications, making products, automation. So we're seeing a lot in that space. I think that any application, certainly, I don't know if you want to call self-driving cars robots, but
yeah, sure.
But if you include that into the spectrum, I think there's a ton of investment there, as well as drones, drones that have autopilot that can act autonomously. There's a great company out of San Francisco called Skycatch that have autonomous drones that will routinely survey a construction site and identify whether things are not to plan in order to catch problems before they're exacerbated.
That's, actually, did you know that the first mention of a robot in popular fiction was actually a self-driving car?
Was it really?
Yeah, it was actually, I'll tell you, I'm just looking it up because I've got it in the research I did for the book Augmented. I came across that because, we talk about robots all the time, right? Mm-hmm. In popular fiction. I mean, we've been, obviously Isaac Asimov and many others have sure. put ro- Aaron Brooks
R-U-R,
into popular fiction, but I'm just starting up the document, but I'll find it as we're talking and let you know. So in terms of the investment going to this, which countries do we see are really heavily investing in that base of expertise or skill sets to develop robotics?
Well, I think it depends how you slice it. I mean, obviously Japan was really first out of the gate there in terms of the investment in robotics. And a lot of that, again, goes back to an aging population, very strict immigration laws, where having robots active in society was very important. I think in the U.S., it's mostly been within the defense budget. You look at like Boston Dynamics, for example. Yeah, exactly. So I think that it depends which slice of the pie you look at. I think in terms of collaborative and social robots, most of the research, the most advanced research seems to be going on in the U.S. at places like MIT and Georgia Tech and Stanford. So
if you go back to 1868, there was an American novel called The Steam Man of the Plains, and it was essentially a steam-driven robotic man that pulled a coach or a horseless coach around.
Fantastic. I'm going to have to add this to my reading list.
I'll send you that. The book was entitled The Steam Man of the Prairies.
The Steam Man of the Prairies. Awesome.
So that was the first depiction of a automated robotic humanoid type form. And it was a steam man that pulled these coaches along. It was 1868. So it's
and
a little bit
different. And here I thought Kit was the first robotic car.
There you go. Yeah. Very, very simple tech compared to what we're looking at now. So we talked about the uncanny valley before and so forth. How do you think people are going to adapt to increasing use of robotics? We talked about Jibo before, Amazon Echo, and these sorts of technologies are starting to bring artificial intelligence and dialogue with machines into the home. Clearly, things like Pepper and iRobot are also gaining ground in self-driving cars. How is humanity going to respond to machines that we can talk to and interact with?
Well, humans are notorious for resisting change. So I think it really varies depending on culture. If you look at pop culture, for example, in the West versus the East, in the West, it's usually the robots have screwed up and the humans have to come in and save the day. And right. In Eastern culture, it's often the humans that have screwed up and the robots that come in and save the day. You think of Astro Boy and things like that.
So
I think that's
a really good point, actually. I like that. Can I use that?
You're more than welcome.
That's good.
But it's really interesting how that impacts people's perception, of their first experience with robots. But I think the thing I would say is, like, for example, even Skype, the technology we're using right now, if you watch little kids use Skype or little kids use iPads, it's seamless, right? I mean, because they don't remember a world
without it. They don't think of it as new. It's just there.
It's just there, right? And they'll play, I've got your nose, or like things that older population would only do in person just because they didn't grow up with the technology. So I think that we're going to see, and in fact, I might even argue the uncanny valley might even cease to exist as children growing up are more accustomed to this type of technology and it becomes more ubiquitous.
I'm definitely with you on that. The
tough thing is around a lot of the conversations. I was asked to speak at a conference in the spring, a human resources conference, and everybody's worried about robots taking our jobs, right? And I'd like to reframe.
So what's your answer to that?
Well, I think it's that let the robots do what they're best at. Let us do what we're best at. And the sum of those, right, the collaboration is really what's going to make us successful, right? I think that there are doing mundane, repetitive, dangerous types of tasks or tasks that require lots of data input, right, are just not things that humans are naturally good at. But being creative and being able to spot the patterns in a lot of noise. And I mean, there are a lot of things that humans are much better at robots at. If you think about that, this is not specifically robots, but artificial intelligence, the Google artificial intelligence that could detect cats in videos.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, we can do it with 75% accuracy. And it's like, any four-year-old can do that with 100% accuracy.
No, so. I know, but pattern recognition is coming along in leaps.
It is. But I think that we've got a long way to go, and there's still plenty of things that humans do better.
Now, it's an exciting time. So tell me, you know, you're now in London doing fintech. So how did you go from robotics to fintech?
Well, it's interesting. We're starting to see, well, there's probably two components of it. One is what I'm trained in is design, and design is a process. And design, it doesn't really matter what the output is. It's the process that you go through to get there. So be it clean energy or robots or, you know, a product for Internet of Things, it doesn't really matter. So now I'm actually applying those same design thinking methodologies to processes, to services, to experiences. And that's kind of what allows me to transfer into the fintech world. But the other thing that we're seeing is the intersection of fintech and the Internet of Things is really interesting, especially as you look at the insurance space. As we have more sensors embedded in our environment, yep. We're going to collect all sorts of data that's going to help us make much more educated decisions about risk, among other things. And so it's that intersection that I'm fascinated by, and we'll have the opportunity to explore in this new capacity.
Very, very interested. Well, we're glad that you've decided to come over to the dark side.
It doesn't seem quite so dark so far.
No, actually, we're bringing light to it, aren't we?
Exactly.
So look, Erica, thank you for joining us from London and giving us some. I'm totally geeking out about this robotic stuff. So I'd love to have you back on. Actually, you know, we often have Ramez Naam on, who's a sci-fi author. He's been doing quite a bit of work with DARPA, but he works on things like brain interfaces and things. I'd love to get Ramez on and you guys talking. I think it'd be an excellent conversation. So hopefully you can come back and join us in the future.
Oh, I would love that. Thanks so much for having me.
So that's Erica Young. She's currently working with our friends over at Anthemis in London and working on some new stuff in the fintech space. Watch this space. And you can. How do we get in touch with you? Are you on Twitter, Erica?
I am. Erica E. Young.
Okay, great. All right, thanks. So let's have a quick break, guys. We'll be back after the break with more goodness. We're going to interview number 26 later in the show. So we'll be right back after this break. This is Brett King, the host of Breaking Banks. We've got some exciting news for you. We've just joined with Radio Everyone and the United Nations on their Global Goals Initiative. Now, this is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. So, Breaking Banks, we're planning a special episode on October the 1st to talk about the organizations around the world that are using fintech to increase financial inclusion, to eradicate poverty, and reduce inequality. Join us at Breaking Banks and the team at Radio Everyone on the UN Global Goals Initiative to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening
listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you're back with Breaking Banks. This is Brett King. We have live in the studio here in New York some visitors from Berlin in Germany. Guten Abend, gentlemen. Welcome to Breaking Banks.
Good to be here.
We have Maximilian Tayenthal and Valentin Stolf, who are the founders, CEO and CFO of Number 26, the German version of Moovin. See, I told you I was going to say that. No, that's not how you guys think of yourselves, I know. But one of the great breakout neobanks in Europe right now, doing some amazing things. Welcome to the show, guys. What brings you to New York?
So actually, we have some board members that are based here in New York, so we'll hear from time to time. And I actually want to see a little bit of the vibrant fintech scene here in New York as well.
Absolutely. Maximilian, tell me, you guys just raised some money in April, right? Do you want to give us a bit of an update on that?
Absolutely. We did our Series A, which was actually backed by our existing investors, Early Bird and Red Alpine, and Valar Ventures, the New York City-based fund, which is...
Valar's Peter Thiel, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah. Actually invested in us.
Great. So how long do you expect that money to last? That's always the question you get from VCs, but how long have you got on $10 million? What's your burn rate right now? Can you disclose that?
Well, the interesting thing in our business is that the better it goes, the earlier you need new
True.
Money.
True, absolutely. Yeah, you know, the more growth you're having, the more money you need. And that's you only keep getting funded if you're a growing business. So that's good news. So how are you guys going in Germany? You're live, right? Tell us about the progress and the reception of your mobile banking solution there.
So I think, we have launched end of January this year, and we have actually seen tremendous traction so far. So we have over 50,000 clients that have opened up an account with us.
Yes.
And I think we're pretty satisfied. So if you would have asked me a year ago, I maybe would have been satisfied with 10,000 customers.
Yeah.
But now we have like over 50,000,
well,
and
done.
We're growing to much more by the end of the year. And that's actually great. And it shows that people are really searching for a new banking experience.
Yeah. And what's been the reception generally? I mean, Germany is a unique market. It has, there's many aspects of Germany where it's very technological, very advanced, but there's also some very strong traditions in Germany. So how does something like a pure play mobile bank fit into the German psyche?
So I think especially with the Generation Y and the younger people, they have lost a lot of trust in the old banks.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that their brands are really like that you trust,
yes.
Especially because of the financial crisis.
Yeah.
So we have seen actually good trust into what we're doing. And we don't so often get the question, is it safe to open an account with you? So it's more they think the transparency within our product and everything is adding a lot to the transparency and the trust into our brand.
Yeah, there was an article on Business Insider a couple of weeks ago here in the US showing that Venmo was the most trusted or most used financial service app for millennials in the United States, right? And this is interesting because you will hear this issue of trust come up over and over again, where one of our commentators, Ron Shevlin, who's done a lot of research, he says, oh no, they still trust the big banks. But that's not borne out by the utility. With the apps that they're using and the things they're doing right now, they're not sticking to just the big banks. So it's not... I don't think it's any longer about trust, actually. I think it's about utility. I think millennials are looking for the best utility to get the job done. I don't think it needs to be based on trust. I think utility is what provides the trust. If it works and my friends use it, that's good enough for me, rather than, oh yeah, you've got these big signs up, so you know I trust you. Max?
I think trust, it's just a factor of hygiene. Like normally if people sign up for a financial product, they of course expect that you don't fuck up with the data and the...
Can't say that sort of thing on the radio show, man.
In Europe you can, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, this is America. Like you can shoot a gun, but you can't swear.
Okay, yeah.
This is great. Max, you're forgiven because you're European.
Yeah. Different cultures apparently.
True.
So I think the customer is not deciding his choice solely on trust, but it's actually he wants to find the right product. And as you were mentioning, Germany, also in Germany, like patterns in terms of banking and payment behavior, they're still traditional, but also in Germany, you see this shift in user behavior, as you have seen in many other industries, like from offline to online to mobile. People used to go into the bank branches, then they did online banking, and now they tend to do more and more mobile banking. And on the other side, the interfaces the German and other European banks offer look pretty much like the internet of the 1990s.
Yeah, exactly. What do you guys think of the blockchain? I know you're not deploying blockchain right now, but do you think in the future we're going to see more of this integrated into solutions like Movin and Number 26?
So actually, we are already a little bit exploring with where we can actually use blockchain technology for core banking parts.
Yeah.
We'll see how that is going to develop over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
I think it's too early to say where it's actually going to be, but I think we're going to be the first ones to also dealing with that. Yeah. Cool. Especially before traditional banks.
Well, we've had Chris Larson on the show a few times from Ripple, and those guys are doing some interesting things. Of course, our friends Fedor, Matthias Kroner. Do you guys know Matthias?
Yes.
Yeah, so, Matthias has been on the show a few times, actually. He's a good friend of ours. So these guys did some early stuff with Bitcoin, but they didn't do blockchain. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with it. Do you guys find that, this is an interesting question here, with Simple and Movin, we always were asked whether we were competing against Simple, but we never found that was the case because it's more so that we're competing with the big banks. So now you guys have got Fedor in Germany, they're in Munich, of course you guys are in Berlin, but do you find that you run into each other or is it just you're both part of the same club of these guys trying to disrupt the banking space?
So I think it's more on the opinion leaders that are asking us about, like, how do you compare to Fedor? But I think if you ask customers,
they don't.
I think you have 100 million retail banking accounts in Germany. We
have plenty
now
of room.
50,000, and I think Fedor has, 80,000 or 100,000.
Yeah.
So I think they're not the guys we are fighting with. Yeah?
Exactly. That's exactly the way we would answer it here with Simple as well. So tell me about what do people like about your product? Why do they come to Number 26? Apart from the fact that it's mobile.
So I think we didn't try to disrupt just like part of banking. We really do. We try to disrupt from the start to the end. So for example, you can open up our bank account within 8 minutes without signing any papers.
Yeah.
You do it completely online with a video conference to verify your identity.
Yeah.
That's like completely
different.
Is this
a German compliance thing?
So you have to verify customers normally by sending them to the post office and if you're an online bank.
Right.
But we do it via video conference call where you show a passport. So that's like a big difference to traditional banks. And I think we also do a lot of small things very different. So how you get the card, how we communicate with you. So we just do it in a nice and friendly and up-to-date way. Yeah, not like
that's interesting.
Traditional banks. And then if you look more at the product, I think it's mainly everything working in real time, being up to date with push notifications all the time. And then a big thing that we're working on is adding more smartness to your account. I think that's also similar to what Movin is working on. But I think there's so much more opportunity that traditional banks are not taking, and that's where we're moving. That's where we're focused on. And then it's all about saving time for users. Giving them
low
more
friction.
Room to do other things, and that's what we focused on, and we're trying to be reachable from everywhere, do banking where you want,
Absolutely. Maxwin, tell us about your team. How many people do you have working at Number 26 now? Where, are you all based in the one office? What's it like?
We have an office based in central Berlin, and we have actually 60 people are working with us, and we're looking for another 70, actually moving into an office that has working space for 150 people.
So you guys are so my guess is you've already started the next raise in terms of money, given, knowing how these mechanics work, that's a lot of people.
So I think, if you really want to build up like take on the big banks.
That's what we want to do.
Then you also have to ramp up the team. You have to have a lot of people that are really smart to figure it out. Because you know it maybe from what you have done here in the U.S. I mean, all these it's a complex industry. Yeah? You have a lot of players in different parts of the value chain, and to look that through, I think it's very important. On the other hand, I think also like customer care is very important.
And having
people that you've trained there, grow the customer service team, because it doesn't mean because you're a mobile bank, you have to be much closer. You're actually much closer to the customer. You're not far away. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we focus
on. So how many are in your support team?
So currently it's around 25.
We think you should make the banking experience actually quite personal. So we even try to call up everyone to welcome him at number 26, every new customer, and get some feedback.
Yeah, good.
We believe that especially at the beginning, you should be really close to your customer and understand what the customer wants.
I agree. I think Simple also had that same model, but we try and build as much of the requirement for humans out of the design, particularly in acquisition, right? So it sounds like you have some tougher regs in Germany for onboarding, because we can do it completely digital here in about 3 minutes. But if they fail the first pass on the doc checks, then we have to call them and get a driver's license or something like that. So, but only if they fail so that's only about 20% of our applicants.
So I give you an example on a traditional bank in Germany. So if you open up a bank account with the traditional German bank, like Sparkasse, for example, the staff there is trained to do that process. At least it should take 1 hour or more.
Oh my goodness!
Because they want to get to know you. So I think that's not that's not up to date. But I learned that just like 2 months ago.
Do Germans like that going in for a bank to get to know you?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Especially not the millennials. That's cool. So where are you guys based in Berlin?
So actually, we're based directly in the center. It's around 5 minutes from Alexanderplatz.
Right in the center.
We're moving into a pretty cool office, because I think the office space, it's different to New York. Yeah. The rent is like not comparable.
Yeah.
It's really low, you would say, being used to New York City prices. But it's a big opportunity, because I think it's all about spirit.
That's actually the good thing about Berlin. We're actually coming from Austria, from Vienna, but we moved to Berlin mainly for recruiting reasons.
Okay.
Because I believe you have to have a certain mindset to work in a startup. And Berlin is actually currently so much hyped as the European startup capital that a lot of people are actually moving to Berlin to work in a startup that have exactly that mindset.
Are your team all locals, or they come from all over Europe?
We have actually more than 20 nations.
Wow.
Which is really cool.
That is. That's very cool. So you can do that in Europe. It's a lot harder to do that in New York. That's very cool. So tell me about the fintech scene in Berlin. Obviously it's growing everywhere in the world, but do you guys have meetups? Is there is there started to be sort of more general awareness about fintech there?
So I think in Germany, actually, fintech scene is split in Germany between Frankfurt, where traditional banks are sitting, and Berlin, where you have all the startups. But I think the cool thing about Europe in general is that it actually just takes an hour flight to be in London.
Yep.
So everything is really connected. I think in Berlin, it's a whole startup community that is great. Yeah, I wouldn't say that there's like a specific fintech scene like it is maybe in London.
Yeah.
It's more about the mindset of working in a startup, and then some people like to work in a fintech and some work in others. Yeah, but I think it's a very vibrant scene, especially the last years has really grown, and it's the driver for Berlin as well.
Yeah,
in general, there's not so much industry in Berlin.
Great. Well, look, thanks guys for coming into the studio today here in New York, all the way from Berlin, and giving us an interview, because normally we'd do this by Skype, but we've got you right in the studio, so it's fantastic. So where can people find out about number 26?
Our website, it's number26.de.
Yep. And what's your Twitter?
Twitter, it's also number26.de.
There you go. Valentin and Maximilian, thank you for being with Breaking Banks live in New York today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
Good luck with the ventures. We look forward to hearing more of your success. Okay, guys, let's have a quick break. Thanks again to our sponsor, Temenos, for supporting the show. And we'll be right back after this quick break.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charge a statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
What do you want your world to look like in 2030? This is Rachel Morrissey, the producer of Breaking Banks, and we are joining the UN Global Goals Initiative and participating in Radio Everyone this week from September 25th to October 2nd. Global Goals is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. To find out more about Global Goals and Radio Everyone, go to www.globalgoals.org.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. You can check out the conversation and participate in the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Our thanks to Temenos, the banking software company, for sponsorship of Breaking Banks. Did you know over 500 million people use Temenos systems around the world in financial services? So they are a core part of the digital revolution of the financial services space, and we're very grateful for their support of the Breaking Banks show. Now, up now, we have a great interview done from our Australian correspondent, Jessica Alerm, and she's done an interview with Chris Brysick, I think is his name, the founder of StockSpot. They're Australia's first robo-advisor startup out of there. So, over to you, Jessica.
Thanks, Brett. Today I'm here with Chris Brysick, founder of StockSpot, Australia's first completely online and automated investment advisor and fund manager. Hi, Chris.
Morning, Jess.
So, Chris, what inspired you to start StockSpot?
Well, Jess, I used to work as a fund manager, and having worked in that industry for quite a few years and growing up investing in stocks, there were a few things about the funds management industry and wealth management industry in general that irked me, and there were things I thought I could get out there and change. So I think a few of them were, first of all, I thought the cost of getting professional advice was too expensive in Australia, and because of the high cost, it prohibits most people from accessing it. So there's a huge group of Australians, and I think similar in other countries, of people who are underserviced or just not serviced at all when it comes to managing their savings and wealth because it's just too expensive to see a traditional advisor. Then on the other side, a lot of people go and then manage their finances themselves, but don't do it in the right way and often take too much risk, which isn't good for them either. And so people are basically stuck between an option that's too expensive and an option that's too risky. And I thought that there was an ability to use technology to open up access to that professional investment side to more people.
Fantastic.
That's what inspired me. And then about 3 years ago, I actually, over Christmas, and this is why I was excited to be interviewed for this show, read Brett's book. And I realized that we were at a big sort of technological juncture. Where a lot of the big incumbent banks were stuck on old technology and really stuck on systems from 10, 20, and 30 years ago. And there was an ability for new nimble technology companies to actually create much more consumer-centric products.
Great. So it's fair to say that we wouldn't be sitting here today if you hadn't read Brett King's Breaking Banks?
Potentially, Jess. I wouldn't go that far, but potentially.
And you touched on it a little bit, but in your opinion, what do you think is wrong with the financial advice industry here in Australia, and how does that open up opportunities for companies like yourself?
Yeah, sure. There's a few things I think are wrong with the industry. So first of all, as I mentioned before, the cost is just too high. So because it costs a few thousand dollars typically to see an advisor. Most people just don't do it. But then not only the cost, but the industry has been built on layers of costs. And you don't just pay one cost when you access professional investment services in Australia and other developed markets. You actually pay layers. And it's those layers that actually end up costing you in the end and ensure that you perform badly over the long term. So
investing is quite complex, especially if you don't have a high degree of financial literacy. How did you think about that when you were actually designing the product?
Well, the beauty is in markets like Australia and the US and Europe that markets or what people invest in are actually quite efficient these days, which means that on average markets are pretty fairly priced, and that's made it more and more difficult for professional investment advisors and managers to actually beat the market, which is actually a great thing for the end consumer, because then they can actually avoid having to pay these high cost managers to manage their money, because they can just invest in the market instead. So what used to be complex because it was actually difficult to find the right person to manage your money, because markets have become so competitive in places like Australia, has actually become a big benefit for consumers. But most consumers don't realise this because the industry still makes people believe that they need to pay these expensive people to manage their money, when in reality, that's not the best product, and actually just getting a low-cost access to the market is the best option. And it's been proven through a lot of empirical and academic research for years and years.
So the design of your product is pretty straightforward. I mean, I've jumped online and I've given it a go and I've tried to apply. How did design principles influence the way that you built that process?
Well, I think Steve Jobs once said, simple can be harder than complex, and we definitely think that's the case in financial services. So if you look back at the history of wealth management in our country, these software products got created in the 70s and 80s called wrap platforms, which were basically technology products that allowed financial advisors who are the distribution to distribute products to the end consumers. And these products were originally quite simple, but over the years have become more and more complex. And the idea of the industry is that you can keep on adding features, and this is what keeps advisors on these platforms. So for 30 years, all of these technology products have all been focused on becoming more and more complex and adding more features, thinking that more features is better. And we brought to wealth management a slightly different philosophy, or in fact an opposite philosophy, that in reality all of these features that have been added have just added a lot of cost. So if you have a look at what the banks spend on their technology platforms in Australia, it's quite unbelievable. One of the big four wealth managers have just spent $500 million redeveloping their wealth management system, which sounds quite impressive before you realise that that cost has to get passed on directly to consumers through higher fees. And they've invested in this technology just to basically update old systems. And for me, this was a great opportunity, because instead of being stuck on these old systems that we had to build technology around, we could create a whole new system that was cloud-based, that used third parties to actually bring down costs, and didn't have that same level of fixed cost or that same level of CapEx that we needed to invest to produce a similar service.
And it's pretty much a paperless process, is that correct?
So that's another thing that I sort of saw in developing the product originally, was one of the issues I thought from a usability perspective for all wealth management services in Australia was that they're all so horrible to apply for. So when I did some research a few years ago, I realised there wasn't a single investment product in Australia that you could sign up for without printing paperwork and giving a bank a wet signature. And I thought this was an extremely archaic process, and one that obviously creates a lot of inertia for customers, because most people are lazy. Most people are too lazy to print off forms and send them in. And in many cases, you also needed to get your ID verified by a JP or a third party, which adds more complexity and more frustration. I recently actually applied for a credit card in Australia, and I thought the process originally was quite good online until I got to the last page, which said, thanks very much, you've almost finished the process, now hit print and take this into a branch so that we can ID you. And I thought this was ridiculous. Like, you're not only wasting my time going into a branch, but also the teller who has to ID me, their time's wasted as well, and all of this time is valuable. Yeah. So we developed the first completely paperless sign-up process for any investment product in Australia. Yeah. And there were no legal hurdles. I mean, the legislation actually changed in the early 2000s to allow digital and electronic signatures that carry the same weight as a traditional wet signature. But most organizations are still stuck just because of their processes on the wet signature system.
Absolutely.
So it gives tech companies like us a great advantage from a usability perspective, because our customers don't need to be frustrated in signing up.
So for a layperson, what does the process look like in applying for StockSpot?
Sure. So customers come to our website where they can find out about what we do, and then they go through a questionnaire process. So we ask them a few questions that gauge their risk tolerance, their investment horizon, how long they're looking to invest for, their cash flow needs, so when they need cash in the future. And then using this information, we basically match the client to a risk optimized or the best portfolio for them using low-cost index funds. So we use funds that are already listed on the Australian Stock Exchange and that cover various global markets, Australian shares, global developed markets, emerging markets, bonds and precious metals. And we combine those assets in a way that matches that client's personal profile. And then clients can complete the sign-up process online. And once they've signed up, we set up in the background a bank account and an investment account for them, and whenever they would like to invest, they simply deposit money from their current bank into their StockSpot account and we invest it for them. We then manage the whole investment process, including rebalancing their portfolio, which is something you need to do over time to reduce the risk in your portfolio, as well as all of the hassles of administration and reporting and tax reports. So,
and when you were building that process out, what did you learn from watching how your users engaged with the platform? Were there any tweaks to design that you made or the user interface?
There have been quite a few. A lot of them actually have come from getting a better understanding of what customers, what our end customers actually understand. And what I realized was a lot of the copy on the website and a lot of the ways we wrote things originally were targeted at a more sophisticated type investor.
Right.
And that was probably my fault, because I probably wrote a lot of the original copy and I came from an investment bank where a lot of words that I thought were commonplace for the average person are quite jargony. So even words like volatility, we realized, don't mean a lot for the average person. So we really had to focus on making the product very understandable for a broad range of people, because our target market isn't just high net worth, sophisticated investors. It's actually the average person out there that has a few thousand dollars to invest and has never invested before.
What role do personas have in building out your product and also your marketing strategy?
Well, I think as any startup, you launch an MVP product, and then you learn more and more about what sort of customers your product appeals to, and then you either go after customers that your product appeals for, or change your product to target customers that have already sort of signed up. So, I mean, I guess we take a bit from both camps. What we noticed quite early on is that our product, because it was servicing a group of people that had no service at the moment in financial services, they were the group that were most interested in our product. So because our minimum investment is $2,000 compared to requiring usually a few hundred thousand dollars to see an advisor, we were seeing lots of clients that had just saved up a little bit of money and were a bit confused about what to do with it signing up. And this typical customer is someone in their 20s, 30s, sometimes early 40s, either pre having a family or with a family sometimes, and the alternatives for them weren't in most cases other investment products, and most of them would never actually consider seeing a financial advisor. Most of them were considering either leaving their money in a cash savings account or putting it into property in Australia, because that's a very popular asset here. So our job, we realised, wasn't actually to convince customers that our service was a viable alternative to setting up a trading account or some sort of investment account. We actually had to position ourselves as an option compared to cash in the bank or property for people with the right sort of investment horizon. So we realised a bit from that perspective. And we also realised, as well as having that younger demographic of customer, we're also seeing a group of older demographic customers. So we've had couples in their 80s sign up to our product online, which impresses me. I hope I'm that tech savvy when I'm 80. And what we realized were these are a group of people who had decided at some point in their life to manage their own savings, but a lot of them, because of poor performance or becoming, taking too much of their time, had decided they wanted to become delegators and give someone else that responsibility. But a lot of these people were naturally quite cynical of the financial services industry. So they were stuck in a position where they didn't want to do it themselves, but they didn't trust anyone else to do it. And we found a lot of those customers who had a bad experience with traditional financial advisors were also people that were attracted to our service.
I know you mentioned before that your existing user base is actually helping drive the acquisition of new customers. Can you walk us through that?
Well, I think with a lot of the most successful tech companies, referral has been a huge source of their customers, and it makes a lot of sense because from a marketing perspective, it's a very cost-effective way of acquiring new customers. So if you have to pay a lot of money for a customer, then it makes it difficult to scale without a huge amount of funding. So the difficulty for financial services is there isn't a natural network effect. So it's not like social media where if your friend's on it, you want to be on it and vice versa. With money and finance topics, people typically don't talk about them.
It's a bit taboo, isn't it?
Yeah, in our country especially, probably more than others, people don't like talking about their finances necessarily. And so it actually makes it difficult for us to create this as a conversation topic, which can then make people talk about our service and talk about how they're happy with our service. So one of the challenges for us is to drive that sort of referral traffic without a natural network effect. But it's something we actually have to do because of how competitive advertising is generally in financial services. So typical channels that startups might try in other industries like online advertising are actually prohibitively expensive in financial services because the incumbents spend so much on them. So the big organizations in Australia have huge budgets to spend just on Google AdWords alone, for instance. So the cost per click in Australia for financial services is ridiculously high and makes no economic sense.
And what's the outlook in terms of competitors in the space? Is still the only one here?
The vision I had for the company 3 years ago led to us launching about a year and a half ago. So it actually took a while to actually build the product in the background and actually have the backing and the ability to launch. And what we've seen is because automated investing and robo-advice and fintech generally, as you know, are becoming quite hot topics, mm-hmm. then we've got a lot of smaller competitors now saying they're going to launch. Now, I think a lot of them will actually realise how difficult it is to launch a financial technology business because of the knowledge you need in regulation and a lot of other areas that you don't necessarily need in other industries. But there will definitely be competitors, and we think that's a great thing. We see it as a way of growing the pie, I suppose. So we have to do a lot of heavy lifting at the moment when it comes to educating consumers about our category. And with a few other competitors who are actually sharing the burden, the category itself should grow a lot faster. The only worry we have is that with any sort of hot industry, it attracts not only good operators, but bad operators. And my worry is that if consumers lose money or have a bad experience with one or two of these dodgy operators, it will reflect badly on our category generally. So part of our job, I guess, is to keep an eye out for operators that aren't necessarily doing the right thing for consumers and make sure that that consumers can't lose their money because, after all, we're trying to create a new category and create a category that's helping consumers get a better deal.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Chris. It's fascinating. Definitely be watching you guys closely as you continue to grow. So thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Jess. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, back to you, Brett.
Well, that's it, guys. Another great show, another wrap on Breaking Banks. I'm going to join you guys next week. We've got a couple of great shows coming up. Just to give you a highlight, next month we have Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Media on the show. There's a lot of really interesting things happening with us, so stay with us through to the end of the year. As always, go to breakingbanks.com if you'd like to check out some of our past episodes or download it on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, etc. That's a wrap. Thanks from me. And I'll speak to you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.